Good afternoon. I'm Darrell West, Vice President and Director of Governance Studies here at Brookings, and I'd like to welcome you to this forum on what healthcare innovation means for consumers. Healthcare innovation creates many opportunities for consumers. It puts them in a position where they can control their own health records, rate physicians and hospitals, learn from other patients, and focus on positive health outcomes. Digital information makes it possible for patients to engage in their own healthcare to a degree not really thought to be possible in an earlier era. But of course, there are many obstacles that make it difficult to take full advantage of the innovations that already have taken place. This includes barriers in terms of how we think about healthcare, the way that medicine is organized, how insurance companies reimburse costs, and disincentives based on government policy. Today, we have put together a distinguished panel of experts to discuss health innovation and tell us what new advances mean for patient quality, accessibility, and affordability. On my far right is Robert Logan. Rob is a senior staff member at the National Library of Medicine of the National Institutes of Health. Rob is a leading authority on health informatics and health communications. He's written a number of different pieces, but one article in particular that is very relevant for our discussion is one he wrote, Developing Tools and Strategies for Consumer-Centered Health Communication. He previously served as a professor at the University of Missouri Columbia School of Journalism, and he currently directs research for the National Library of Medicine's Office of Communications and Public Liaison. Aurelia Boyer is right next to me, is Senior Vice President and Chief Information Officer at New York Presbyterian Hospital. She has seen all aspects of medicine. She started her career as a registered nurse, but now deploys new lab and patient monitoring systems for the hospital. She is on the front lines of medical innovation by showing how information technology can improve healthcare beyond some of the techniques that we've already seen, such as computerized physician order entry and electronic medical record systems. New York Presbyterian aims to improve quality in ways that aren't yet formally measured, and she is helping to develop some of the new metrics that take into account what actually happens in hospitals and how we can tie treatment to actual health outcomes. To my left is Jamie Haywood. Jamie is a co-founder and chairman of PatientsLikeMe.com. He entered the medical field in 1998 when his brother Stephen was diagnosed with ALS. He and his leadership team have been innovators in the areas of biotechnology, personalized medicine, and new forms of patient care. His organization emphasizes patient-centered medical information. It helps patients share in-depth information on the symptoms they are experiencing in a variety of chronic conditions, the treatments that they're getting, and outcomes that each of the patients is noting. This helps clinicians, providers, and drug manufacturers understand the disease from the standpoint of the patient. His work has been profiled on 60 Minutes, the CBS Evening News, NPR, and in the New York Times, in Business Week, and Science and Nature, among elsewhere. His family's experiences have been the subject of Pulitzer Prize winner Jonathan Weiner's biography, His Brother's Keeper, and in the Sundance Film Festival documentary, So Much, So Fast. Our last panelist on my far left is Nate McLemore. Nate is the Director of Business Development and Policy of the Health Solutions Group at Microsoft. Among his responsibilities are working to improve the ability of information systems to communicate with one another, developing web-based medical records, and linking health information to patient outcomes. Prior to joining Microsoft, Nate was Vice President of Business Development for Relay Health Corporation, an online doctor-patient communication provider. And previously, he held positions as Director of Business Development for Eastscript Corporation, and he also was Director of Federal Affairs for CFM, a public affairs firm in the health IT area. So I think we're going to have a conversation on the panel, and then we will open the floor to questions and comments from you. But I'd like to start with Rob. I mean, you have written extensively on consumer-centered healthcare. Why don't you start just by defining for us what is consumer-centered medicine and what it means for individual patients? And then I know you heard David Blumenthal, the health IT coordinator for Health and Human Services, speak this morning, so you might address whatever insights he offered as well.
I think I'll start with what Dr. Blumenthal said. The best definition I've ever seen in consumer health informatics is in a new AHRQ report, and I'll give you the site later. I'll have to dig it out. But it's by far the best definition I've ever seen and the most comprehensive and been the best thought through. By the way, the same AHRQ report reviews 146 research studies that have been done about consumer health informatics all across the country and essentially argues that there is evidence of its efficacy across a whole wide range of issues. And so the way to describe it to you is that's the first macro-type report that's ever said that there is hard scientific evidence that the intervention and the utilization of consumer health informatics services is clinically efficacious and also helpful to patients. And I've never seen it addressed that squarely in my life or that comprehensively. Others in the panel can disagree with me. By the way, there's some recommendations in the report that personally I think are nonsense, but that doesn't matter. I still appreciate what they've done. And by the way, now that I've said that, I ought to say that I speak for myself and not for the National Library of Medicine and not for the National Institutes of Health or the federal government. By the way, my thanks to the Brookings Institute for the invitation to be here, and also my thanks to Dr. Patty Brennan of the University of Wisconsin, who asked me to pitch it for her today. I appreciate it, Patty. Blumenthal's and other people were, there is a Consumer Health Informatics Summit going on, sponsored by six or seven different federal entities that's going on in Potomac as we speak. Today, tomorrow, and a couple other people on the panel were also there earlier today. This is what I got out of his comments this morning. Remember, Dr. Blumenthal is a very careful speaker, okay? He is very careful to define the parameters of what he talks about in a very narrow fashion. So therefore, whenever he pushes the envelope a little bit, I get very interested in what he has to say, because normally he doesn't do that. First of all, he gave a quote right at the beginning that I found to be very interesting. I think I got it word for word. Health information technology is the most efficient circulatory system for the lifeblood of healthcare, which is information. I can't say it any better than that. Okay. Then he talked about two realities that he saw as problematic later on in his discussion. The first is that he believes the pressing need for the evolution and development of consumer health informatics. He believes the most pressing need, or may be, because physicians and patients are basically increasingly strangers all across the United States, much more than in the past. He didn't say this in his talk, but I've heard him talk about it in the past, that it is not unusual at all in major medical centers today that are not HMOs for a person who's being admitted to lose contact completely with their primary care provider, and that person is sent over to the specialist inside the hospital. They're complete strangers. They've never met the person before. And not only that, the specialist doesn't necessarily communicate with the primary health provider. That decision is made institutionally. It's not necessarily made by referral the way it used to be. So, again, I'm describing you something that I hope you know that is now common practice. It's been common practice for years in HMO institutions, but it hasn't been in others. And what we're seeing now is an increasing environment where physicians and their patients are strangers. And I think that one of the things that Dr. Blumenthal argues is that reality creates a pressing need for everything we're going to talk about today. The other thing he talked about, which is a barrier, okay, which I find to be really interesting, is essentially the poor adoption of health information technology within the medical profession. These are his figures that he gave today. He didn't use a citation, but I've seen similar sites in recent articles in JAMA, New England Journal of Medicine. Essentially, about 17% of physicians have adopted. Health information technology for use in clinical care. We're not talking here about billing, okay? And among hospitals and other institutions, the figure he gave this morning, the adoption rate is around 10%. My personal opinion is it may be slightly higher than that, but nevertheless, okay, regardless of the point he was making was to juxtapose that with the Pew statistics that show that 73% of Americans now routinely, okay, go to the internet to get health information. I hope I just got through to many of you. There is an obvious chasm there. We're talking about larger than the Grand Canyon that is emerging. Here we have consumers driving, getting information as a matter of routine from sources such as the ones that Microsoft provide or Medline Plus or WebMD or whatever, okay? And we have the hospitals and the providers that the same patients use that are not essentially using the same technology. We had a study that we had to do a couple of years ago where the primary condition of the study was that the providers in the study, it was a health education intervention using Medline Plus, where the providers in the study had to have had several years of routinely emailing patients. That had to be a routine part of their practice for the study to work. I see people smiling on the panel. You wouldn't believe how hard we had to look to find a place where that was the condition. It shouldn't have been that difficult. And I think that that ought to tell you something. Because of time, I won't go over, but we can come back to later. Big innovations. I think the best innovation that we have right now is something that other members of the panel know a lot about, particularly the person on my left. And so I'll let them talk about it more. But the thing I'm really excited about is when you take a comprehensive consumer health informatics data set and you combine it with a patient health record, and the result is, as you look up information about your particular condition, that you can retrieve tailored, specific information from that source about the medications you're taking, about the etiology of your own illness, and you can use that to ask and get much more information if you prefer, including even links to PubMed that tell you the research that's been published. That's something that I'm very excited about. That's an innovation that is fairly fresh and new, but there are others of the panel can address that better than I can. The area that in terms of barriers that is not discussed very often and should be. Whenever I hear about, I hear interoperability discussed all the time, and certainly was discussed by Dr. Lumenthal this morning. But when interoperability is addressed, it's always addressed in terms of essentially tools and technology. That's important, but there's a key issue which is never discussed in terms of interoperability, which is absolutely critical. The medical language you're using. Why is it that we have lots of developments, okay, of patient electronic health record system that don't map to ICD-9 codes, that don't map to UMLS, the Uniform Medical Language System? Do you realize how difficult it is, okay, to take somebody's medical language and to transfer it over, okay? That is an interoperability at the, it may be at 30,000 feet, but the process of doing that is enormously laborious. It is not nearly as laborious as it was 10 years ago, I'm happy to say, but nevertheless, that's a very fundamental issue, okay? If you're not, we don't have a consistent mapping, okay, to medical language, consumer and professional, that cuts across the board, then it's, again, in case you don't understand what I'm saying, then it's almost impossible to develop a search engine that if you type something in will get what you want. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay, that mapping across language is the key to a great search engine. That's why Microsoft Bing works so well and some of their competitors. They're very good at those sorts of things.
question.
That is a fundamental issue in interoperability that is not discussed very often in settings like this. It certainly hasn't been discussed in policy issues as well. That directly not only affects us, but also is an issue that I think should be on the table and should be on the agenda. And that is not a complex issue to resolve. All it takes is will to do it.
Okay, thank you. Aurelia, Rob is extolling your expertise here, and you are CIO at New York Presbyterian. Give us a CIO perspective, especially from the hospital standpoint, in terms of what hospitals are doing to improve quality.
First of all, let me thank you for having me here. It's an honor to be down here at Brookings. And indeed, I'm charged with running the information technology in the hospital. And in a pretty large hospital at New York Presbyterian, so we have over 2,200 beds across five acute care facilities. And we have two medical schools, so our hospitals merged, but our medical schools do not. And the physicians work for the medical schools, and some of them that admit patients to a hospital, of course, are independent practitioners. So in some ways, my institution is a small version of the whole country. Some places, the physicians are employed by the hospital, and there are tighter linkages. But in a place like ours, which represents a lot of institutions, that's not really true. So to Dr. Blumenthal's point, we've spent a lot of money and time automating our hospital, and indeed, I'm proud to say we'd be in the 10% or the 25% who have automated almost every aspect of our clinical operations. Physicians do utilize our systems. They do write their orders in it. They do write their notes in it. The nurses write their notes in it. So that provides me with the opportunity to actually do things with electronic data and start moving them. But a little while ago, we started talking about data interchange in the industry and interoperability as well as that can be defined. And I would sit at a table in Manhattan with CIOs from what are competing hospitals, and basically people look at each other and say, well, I'm not going to send my data to any of you. Why would I do that? Right? Our sort of business model does not induce us to get on with that business. In addition, the early discussions about patient portals were about tying the patients to the hospital or to the provider, right? We want your loyalty. We want you to come back. We want your business. So it was more a, let me peek into my records that are at your hospital or any aspect of it, but you couldn't do anything with it. But then I would look at a company, at the work that patients like me did, and you go, well, wait a minute. Why are we doing this? Why do we come to work every day? I started as a nurse. I work in an institution that's about the patients. It really is, believe it or not. We have a mission around patients. And so we came to say we want to release this data to our patients. This is their data. We're custodians of the data. We are not the owners of the data. And my leadership believed that. And so we looked at the opportunities that things like Microsoft Health Vault provided us. And we said, well, we're going to do this. And so we went about the business of creating something. We call it MyNYP. I'm also fortunate. Dr. Mehmet Oz actually works at our institution. And so if any of you have seen Dr. Oz, he's sort of famous from Oprah mostly, but he's written a series of books, and they're always in Costco, so I know a lot of people must be buying them, that are about you, the patient. So I joined up with Dr. Oz, and we created this vehicle that says, here's your record. And it's not your entire medical record. I know people always ask me that. It's a summary of your record. It is based on a standard that the industry is evolving called the CCR. And we know those are the data elements you need to avoid the problems that happen in transitions of care. So where do we have quality issues? If you look at the studies, medication errors, the kinds of things, it's always in these handoffs from our hospital to another hospital or back to the provider. We're tertiary care place. You know, people come to us from a long ways away. Hand it off to your description of an academic medical center. So using the patient is that safety net, is Dr. Oz's philosophy. I think things like MyNYP and Health Vault that allow the patients to take their data with them were critical. So we wanted to do that early. We've done it. It's available to all our patients. We've been rolling it out, and their response is tremendous. I mean, it's so exciting to see patients actually go, wow, you mean this is my EKG? And it does try to teach them while they get them things with hoverovers and additional information, other types of education that are available on the Internet, but we bring it to them. So if you're having valve surgery, you know, it's there for you as you go through the process. So we're really excited about the work. I think it's and the other really important part about doing it in this way as opposed to the traditional portal is allowing the patients to use whatever tools are out there. So the marketplace of tools, whether it's something like patients like me, in the past, patients have to enter all their data in order to make something like that work for them. So here you envision the thing where we're going to assist the patients to do those kinds of things and that there be a marketplace of tools. So rather than NYP try to build this elaborate patient portal with a zillion tools that cover every condition, you say the American Heart Association has the best tool out there for dealing with your hypertension. Use that tool. I don't have to write that tool. And funding our internal work is a strain, a financial strain on our hospital. So here's, I think, an efficient way for us to assist the marketplace in moving this along. So that's, you know, sort of our big consumer piece. Certainly I can, you know, speak a lot to automating hospitals, a little bit about other things we're doing with quality. Because once you have this data, so what I fundamentally have done is you automate the data. You have to bring the data together. It's just across, you know, hundreds and hundreds of systems. It's not one big clinical information system in an organization like ours. Use that data for both quality purposes internally, efficiency purposes internally, as well as assisting our consumers.
Thank you. Jamie, patients like me. It's a new model for patient collaboration in healthcare. Explain how it works.
Actually, I think I want to reflect for a second, because I one of the things that I'm always fascinated by in healthcare are amazing stories of people doing things that are for the patient despite the fact that we pay them not to. I love the platform you're building, and I love the effort and the incentive, but, you know, I remember the data from Partners Healthcare when they turned on the ability to share labs across the hospital, lab orders dropped by 30%. And if you make money on lab orders, you know, are you likely to turn on an MRI sharing platform to drop your MRI revenue by 30%? Unlikely. So I think, you know, one of the things that I think people don't get is that we are all fundamentally fighting an economic infrastructure. And I like to think of it in the following way. I have chosen to define caring, because I think healthcare is about caring. I have chosen to define caring as measuring an outcome. That if you care about something, you measure it. It's actually a very sort of standard business definition. If you care about profits, you measure them. If you care about the quality of your cars, you measure them. If you care about the quality of your hamburgers, you measure them in your customer service. And by the definition, that definition of caring, investment in measuring the meaningful outcomes of what your business produces, I find it interesting that the only one in healthcare that really cares in any significant way is the pharmaceutical industry. That they're the only ones that invest any significant portion of their revenue in measuring the outcomes of what they do with the people they modify their outcomes. And that is accepted by immense individual efforts within the context of hospitals. And what I love about this model, and I think, I'm just predicting, but, you know, no good deed goes unpunished. So as you open up this amazing system and you transform your hospital to being more and more effective and you come to standards of care that make patients' outcomes better, the consequence will be lawsuits against you for failing to meet the standards that you are already operating above anyone else because you bothered to measure them. And I think we need to really recognize just how broken the economics are and how powerful the incentives that you need to operate against to begin to deliver patient-centered care, which gets to what patients like me is. So my background is drug development discovery. My brother had ALS. I ran an institute for 10 years. My brother, Ben, is a CEO, used to work for a company that developed and manufactured coils to treat aneurysms. Our CTO is an author on a biostatistics paper in mouse studies. And our head of business development is a former pharma person. And we are, and people think we're sort of this group of engineers coming in to do healthcare, but we're not. We're really interested in discovering what works in the treatment of disease. And why is that? What does that mean? So what we have chosen to do is to pick a group of diseases where we don't have to engage the medical system, where we can get the patients to tell us their health status in an entirely patient-centered health framework. And this is the really important transition. We decided to do this using a new social contract, which is that all of the data in our system is fully open and transparent. So that if you are an MS patient in our system, you will tell everyone with MS in the world how sexually dysfunctional you were in the last week. And there are 15,000 people doing that now in MS. And I can drill and I can see the 2,360 of them that are suffering from severe sexual dysfunction. And if I want to, I can email each of them individually and talk to them. And the reason this is really important, and I think this transition cannot be underestimated, is that once you build a fully open medical platform, a fully open medical information network that measures an outcome, that you can then essentially crowdsource the optimization of care paradigms. You can look at, in real time, interactively, what is modifying outcomes in individuals. And in fact, some of the tools we're developing now, we're building systems dynamics models of pathology and disease so that we can predict the future state of each individual in our system so they can have a baseline on which to fight against. So if you have MS and you have a certain level of functional ability in your thinking or your walking or your pain, we will tell you the probability of each of those future states a year from now and give you something to operate against to see if you can do better than that. And I think that model, that goal, that objective, delivered with patient-centered graphs and understanding, is what an idealized version of what healthcare could be if we could overcome the fact that the system has incredible sets of rules that prevent it from participating in that process in some effective way. And I think it's worth talking about some of those today. I think one of the things that I find interesting about our company, and it's worth looking at just the front page of the website, you can see some of the information on it, I don't know why we exist. I'm trying to imagine us existing in another industry that actually paid for value in any way. I mean, we just wouldn't. I mean, it's absurd that there would be this, company that went out and built a new information platform that was entirely voluntary and entirely inefficient, that invented outcome measures that were relevant to human beings because it mattered to the customer. And I think it's worth, pointing out, I think the invention that we really came up with is that we found a way to make money measuring health outcomes. Now, I'll just repeat that. We take all of this data from all these patients, and we go back to the only one that we've identified invests in caring in patients, which is the pharmaceutical industry, and we've modified their outcomes. So, if you have a good drug, you hire us to understand how it's better. If you have a competitor with a bad drug, you hire us to show that the competitor's drug is not as good. And it's sad that it is that invention that came from not someone that was involved in the healthcare system that allowed us to begin to measure healthcare. And we had to start in areas that operate outside of the healthcare system because the data on which to make good decisions is unavailable in oncology or in cardiology or in areas where we could actually also make a real difference if we could get access to it.
Thank you. Nate, one of the big problems in healthcare has been mentioned already, interoperability. And Aurelia was talking about this so-called handoff problem, the fact that different parts of the system have difficulty communicating with other parts and aren't able to talk very effectively with one another. How can we improve communications across different parts of the medical system?
Well, it's funny you bring that up. I flew in this morning from Seattle, and it was an overnight flight, and I was late to the airport, as I often am, and so was not able to put my bag in the overhead bin, and ended up at baggage claim at Dulles at about 5:30 this morning, and was standing there with about another 100 kind of weary travelers watching the spinning turnstile waiting for our bags to come out. And I was reminded of a recent study by ITI, which looked at the adult patient population. And in that population, 44% of the population said that within the last year, they were responsible for, or they had a need to move data between two doctors or between a hospital and a doctor. And of that 44%, nearly half said the data didn't get there. So I was looking at all these weary travelers saying, that's about like half these bags not showing up. Maybe some of the bags come tomorrow, some of the bags come with half the clothes in it, and some of the bags never come at all.
And you spent $100.
And the consequence of that for me would have been, you know, sitting up here in a T-shirt and some sweatpants and maybe spending some extra money at CVS. But if we think about the consequence, and yet we don't tolerate that in the airline industry, yet if we think about the consequence for health and our individual health, both in terms of the quality of care we get as patients and the cost in the system, Jamie talked about repeat tests and that type of thing, it's simply intolerable. And so what can you do about it? I think there's a number of things happening. You know, we applaud what Congress and the administration are doing around high tech in terms of not just rewarding providers and hospitals, physicians and hospitals, for adopting IT, but actually using it meaningfully. And one of the tests of that is not just the exchange of data, but it's actually outcomes-driven. And that begins to, I think, address some of the things that Jamie talks about, in that people don't really have an incentive to move the data. And it's not that they can't, and it's not that the standards don't exist, it's that the business models don't exist. And so, in some ways, the High Tech Act is putting a little bit the cart before the horse, and it'll help stimulate some of the right thing to do. But absent real payment reform, it'll be challenging to do that. At Microsoft, we invested in a consumer-controlled health platform called Health Vault, which allows individuals to basically collect their individual health information, store it in the cloud, and more importantly, be able to share it with different parts of their healthcare life. And all of us as consumers have data scattered all over. Some may be at the pharmacy, some may be at our health plan, some may be at a doctor. And because of that sort of fragmentation of your healthcare picture, it's very hard to feel empowered. And once you begin to pull that together, you get to have a more empowered picture of yourself as a patient. And then what we've done is created a platform that devices can plug in and applications can plug in. So applications like the NYP portal, a number of consumer applications from organizations like the American Heart Association, American Cancer Society, Planned Parenthood, that may help you meet the needs of your individual health. But then you become not only you have the ability to help move the data and solve that continuity of care problem, but also begin to be more engaged and empowered. So the two things, if we're really to address both the cost and quality issue for consumers, I think one, it's about having better data transport and data reuse, so getting the data moving. But secondly, patients need to change their behavior. And so it's up to us as an IT industry to create the type of platforms that drive a lot of innovation in terms of ways in which we can do that. But if you don't have a complete picture of yourself, it's very hard to be empowered. So we think the two go hand in hand. And of course, thinking about it from a payment system and the economics around that is super critical. I would say that while I agree with what Jamie said about the economics, there are some positive economics for doing the right things for patients. And a couple of examples that come to mind are hospitals that are using the technology to help patients get a copy of their data. That drives patient satisfaction. It also helps with the referring provider because they can get a more complete picture of what happened in the hospital. In patient satisfaction and keeping a strong referral network certainly help the economics of the hospital. The other example that comes to mind is the Cleveland Clinic is doing a pilot with Health Vault, and what they've done is discharged hypertensive patients with a set of devices and some tools that they can go online and use those devices and then report that back to the clinic. And the Cleveland Plain Dealer did an article about a truck driver who was driving all day and at night would pull into the truck stop, take the reading off his blood pressure cuff, and send it back to the clinic. And what was happening is the medication that he was discharged with did not help him regulate his blood pressure in the right way. So by communicating electronically with his physician at the clinic, he was able to dial that back and get into the right sort of medication treatment protocol. And certainly hospitals have economics around avoiding readmissions of patients. And so those are some examples of the types of economics that are useful that help people do the right thing. Certainly there's more that can be done and should be done in that regard.
Jamie, you have a reaction to that?
I was going to say hospitals have economics about avoiding readmission of patients, which is that they make money causing readmissions. It's not that they save any money. There is no economic, I'm a huge fan of Microsoft Health Vault. I think they're doing an incredible data layer. I think the service that they provided for free with Google as well to the country for defining data exchange standards is incredibly valuable. But I also think hospitals make more money keeping people sick.
But there are readmission rules that you're penalized if somebody gets readmitted.
Those are just starting to come into play now. They're new now. I mean, they're really new. So we're preparing for them, though, Jamie. Yeah. I mean, we believe that we have a role in that and we're taking those things on as we speak. And having the data so that so we also use the Microsoft Amalga project, which is so it can bring all this data together. And so I just now, and it's new because we know readmissions are going to change on us, and so we're trying to be ahead of the curve. Said to the hospitalists, who are the people who in my institution take care of you when you're real, your physician, you have your relationship with, you don't see anymore, right? So you're turned over completely to a different set of physicians. That they can look at this tool now and they can find the causes of those readmissions, that they can understand the patterns of things that are going on in our institution and make a difference. Because even though the incentives are bad, they don't want to cause the readmission. You're right, as a business, we're rewarded for that. But let me assure you, that's not what people who care for patients are out there trying to do. So we are perversely incentivized to do the more expensive procedure. We understand that. But you don't see hospitals not developing stents and non-invasive procedures and all those kinds of things we do at our institution, even though we're going to get economically hit for it. So how we balance that and stay viable, that's a challenge that, my CEO has to face.
I think the interesting issue here that I struggle with is that the evidence is, against all incentives, doctors and healthcare professionals are incredibly good human beings because they are essentially paid to make people sick, and they don't, and they generally do much better than that. But I also think it's interesting that, that Mayo, one of the examples you cite, from a business standpoint, if you measure their capture of Medicare dollars, sucks. I mean, they're just not very efficient. They don't get paid very well for what they could get paid relative to the other institutions that do far worse care. So what's interesting is we have this problem of talking about our future state, and I think we should focus on the consumer here because I think it is what about today. But I think sometimes we fail to acknowledge just how anti-consumer the economic architecture in which we operate are. So I think we are headed to much better states, and I completely agree with you that any business or hospital that is not collecting the information such that when, David's new rules, which I hope come into effect really soon, make it so that you actually get paid for making people healthy, don't get caught off guard. I think we just need to understand just how far from a consumer-focused healthcare system we are, and I think we don't lay that baseline well enough as a speaker.
Let's, if I can add a note of perspective here. I hope it's perspective for all of you. I mean, prevention and the development of a healthcare delivery system that is preventive in nature and where that encourages the development of health information systems is a priority of this administration, but it also was a priority of the last one, which often was not discussed widely as it probably should have been. I think that tells us something, okay? The issue is now, as so many politicians love to say, the devil's in the details. But nevertheless, the thrust of the direction of national policy seems pretty clear to me. The issue is how are you going to provide incentives for people to do those things. Now, the incentives for health information systems are being provided by a series of bills that have been passed over a number of years that fund the development of a lot of systems in areas where in medical institutions and even among providers that claim they couldn't afford them. Is that comprehensive? Is that going to solve the problem by in and of itself? No, but at least there is comprehensive legislation that has gone about and addressed those two issues. As long as I got the floor, I found the definition. Okay, can I just read it? Sorry, it won't take long.
It's brief.
I hope it's brief. This is the best one of consumer health informatics I've ever seen. We define consumer health informatics applications as any electronic tool, technology, or system that is primarily designed to interact with health information users or consumers, anyone who seeks or uses healthcare information for non-professional work, and interacts directly with the consumer who provides health information to the consumer health information system and receives personalized health information from the tool, application, or system, and one in which the data, information, recommendations, or other benefits provided to the consumer may be used with a healthcare professional but is not dependent on a healthcare professional. That is light years beyond anything that I've ever seen.
Okay, Aurelia, I want to come back to a point that Nate was raising about the need for payment reform. And I'm just curious, when you think about either the actions of insurance companies or what the federal government is now envisioning in terms of healthcare reform, are they going far enough in terms of making changes to create incentives for consumer involvement with healthcare?
Well, I think the fact that we're challenged on quality for the first time is a good thing for all of us. I mean, I'm a consumer of healthcare too, so I can view this very much as a consumer, and I often look at the work we do with that in mind, whether it's my mother who's approaching 90 or whether it's my husband who has some chronic illnesses and how does he deal with the health system. And I'm an insider, and it's not easy. I mean, I'm going to say that right out. And we have been, I think, reluctant to release our quality data or to even try to measure our quality. And it's too complex, and tort reform, is not part of the agenda at this point. And so certainly I think that should be part of the agenda to really get at these issues, including quality. So I think you do a good thing when you bring that up, Jamie, because people are not too interested in talking about that at this point in time. But we are measuring our quality now, and it's a complex measurement. And so as CMS is putting measurements out there, so the consumer now can go on the internet and say, here's your scores on smoking cessation and how you manage congestive heart failure and what are your mortality rates. And we want to do that, and we want to help contribute to how those are defined, because what is really scary to us is the wrong measures are going to be out there. So right now, if you looked at some of the CMS indicators and you compared them to the mortality rates and where the scores are, some places who have are not doing the CMS measures as well are getting better mortality scores. So do we really know which one of these things consumers should be looking at? Well, we absolutely don't right now. So again, without us internally, doing that and getting electronic data, which we've never had in an extensive way too. I mean, we need a lot of data to get at these things. So I don't think we're going to get there in one leap. We're not going to do this overnight. It's not going to happen with one healthcare reform legislature. It's going to take a lot and a lot of progress and a lot of work over the years. But I think the consumers need to demand it. I mean, we want you to be active in your care. I think that's going to help do that. If the consumers don't want health care reform, it's not going to happen. And I think that's been a struggle for a lot of years now. So everybody wanted health care reform before the election. When they start hearing the specifics of health care reform, everybody's not quite so sure if they really want health care reform because it might impact them and their relationship with their doctor. And so that's not working very well for us. It has, you know, it hasn't worked. So I think getting at quality is the only way we're ever going to get at that.
Jamie?
You know, I think there's one of the big problems we have in talking about healthcare is that it's not one thing. And not only is it not one thing, but if you look at I almost view this as a grid. You know, if you have an appendicitis, you know, you have a fairly optimizable diagnostic solution, measurable outcome solution space. You could bracket out. You can measure it. It's fairly straightforward. You can do it, and we could deliver better value in that context. If you have chronic depression, that is a much different problem than a patient that's suffering from congestive heart failure, than someone that is coming in at the end of their life and wants to die with dignity, than a child that is suffering with a, you know, severe bronchitis that could become pneumonia. These are all very different problems. You look at this whole grid of, you know, I always vision of a grid of like 100 case examples. And then you overlay the other component to that, which is that we really have three, I break them into three classes of healthcare consumers in this country, which are sort of the sort of at-risk population that you know, quite frankly, have demonstrated their inability to care for themselves. You could think of it as the homeless or borderline, you know, public health, the public health crisis we face, which draw inordinately on the hospital infrastructures of cities. And then you have the sort of rational consumer, which is just your everyday human being that is not an expert but goes in and can make rational choices like they can about cars and everything else. And then you have this sort of these experts that are people that become advocates and real innovators in their disease. And so if you take these three types of people with the grid of 100 problems and you look at, you know, the hospital as a monolithic architecture for addressing them, and you think about trying to measure outcomes in that space, it just becomes obviously a rapidly impossible problem. And I think it does come back to this devil's in the details. But this is where I do think consumers can really add a lot. And where I worry a lot about health reform and the way it's sort of being thought about a little bit monolithically is that we are failing to really address the public health issue, which is a huge cost drain and awful. We are failing to provide effective incentives to the rational consumers to make them part of the good decision process. And we are actually, at some level, taking away the innovator's ability to manipulate the system to produce better outcomes that drive the innovation. So we are, at some level, degrading our ability to address, well, we're not degrading the public health one, that just sucks, period, but we're degrading our ability in the other two areas to make the system better. And I think we are being dishonest. We're having an intellectually dishonest conversation about these different needs. I mean, we have to address public health. It is cheaper for me to keep someone who is at risk healthier than it is to not. I mean, I don't care about their health. It's just cheaper. and we have to, you know, place rational consumer incentives in the cost architecture for the rational consumers. But we also, in America, really should be cautious about losing this innovation space, losing the power of the collaboration between innovators and the academic institutions. And I think where companies like ours, be nice to find a way to have the innovators that are beginning to build these knowledge frameworks that are specialized. Now, I build specialized outcome frameworks. To send that back into the system in an effective way. And I think what's sad is I can't think of any economic architecture in healthcare today where anyone, you know, if I could raise my hand and say, you know what, I could tomorrow deploy a measurement framework for multiple sclerosis that would lower the cost of managing this disease by 10% a year for the next 20 years on an annual basis, improve outcomes across the board, lower the cost of developing drugs, and drive incentives across the entire system. No one will pay me. Not a prayer, not a hope, not a hope in the world. Maybe the pharmaceutical industry because they want the drugs. I mean, and that's what we do. And so I think that problem, whether it be me or the Microsoft platform that they're empowering by letting the Microsoft, the fact that there is no incentive for the entrepreneurs, for the innovators to bring this system back in is where consumers are failing to allow us to drive that. And it's not just consumers making rational choices. It's consumers defining the values of the system on which it should be judged. And I think that's where the real consumer empowerment is, and one that I think also requires a lock, stepping back from a control standpoint at the medical information system. Because at the end of the day, it really matters what me as an MS patient or me as an ALS patient or me as a depression patient want as an objective rather than, you know, what someone else as a proxy for me wants.
Nate, what do you view as the major obstacles to consumer engagement now, and how should we overcome them?
Well, I think part of it is you don't have a complete picture of your information. So, you know, the data is moving. One of my colleagues likes to describe when people say, you know, should you have your data online or is it safe to have your data electronically? The fact is all of our data exists in electronic format, and it is online and it is moving. You're just not participating in it, and you don't have a picture of it. And he describes it as you're sitting at the kids' table in terms of your data. And so I think the first thing that we believe is that you get consumers to be able to have a copy of that, whether it's downloading it, discharge summary from their hospital, getting a sync with their doctor's EMR, getting a download from their health plan. So, you know, health plans like Aetna, for example, are interfacing to Health Vault. So being able to first aggregate that, and then Health Vault's an open platform that then they can take that data and go find applications that might be helpful to them. So I mentioned people like Planned Parenthood and American Cancer Society and others are building those applications. And it's still early. And it's sort of this two-step process where you need consumers to have data. But we very much believe in an open platform. Well, there'll be a long tail of innovation where people like Jamie's company and others will create very useful ways in which people can get insight from their data. There's a company called TrialX that has an application on Health Vault that allows individuals to take their personal health record, share it with that application to find a clinical trial that would be right for them. And in the richness of the data that they can collect and do that, Navigenics is another company that does genetic testing, and people can basically get a genetic test, store their strip online in Health Vault, but get advice about what to do. So it's about getting the data, but then creating an environment, both with economics, but also with an open set of programming interfaces for a long tail of people to intersect with that data in a way that will create the kind of engaging innovation that hopefully will get consumers there.
Did you have a comment?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the problems we have is most of the consumers aren't motivated. And so you find the people who are ill are motivated to use their data and collect their data. And I think research and things like patients like me show that. And in fact, they're less worried about the privacy, as you very well demonstrated, where the people who are well aren't all that interested. In fact, I think most people abdicate completely to the physician and say, well, why didn't you call me and tell me what my result was, rather than I'm going to actively participate in monitoring my own results and doing that. So I don't think, for the most part, people are motivated to do that. And to your point, Jamie, I think you bring up the right thing. Where are the incentives to stay healthy? And so America's not at the right weight to be healthy. And these tools and their interventions and their relationship with our providers could be an active part of that through things like Health Vault and monitoring yourself at home and bringing these things together so you stay healthy and you stay out of the hospital and your congestive heart failure is in control or you never get there. And I don't think there are any incentives for that. And I think people are uncomfortable talking about it because we don't want to tell people how they should live their lives. So I think we've got a long way to go on actually getting the consumers that are healthy engaged in the process.
So you don't want to tell people they're fat, basically?
Some people don't want to, but others people do tell them. So, but I don't think as a country we're too comfortable with that.
Well, some of this goes back to what you talked about on ontology and language earlier. I mean, I want to disagree with you because I think we don't necessarily have – I think – if you look at the history of standards and information and language, I mean, we've coded all of our data back to MedDRA and ICD-9 and ICD-10, and you know, those tools relate to the problem you're trying to solve. And when you talk about people are not engaged, it's boring. It's medical. It doesn't. I mean, it's not engageable. I mean, you know, if I get an image or a cholesterol level or something, it doesn't say anything useful to me. I mean, Wolfram Alpha. You know, I type in my cholesterol in there, and it tells me more useful information than the doctor ever does. So I do think we have a design problem, and I think this is where Microsoft has, you know, the right sort of long-term vision here, which is that, you know, yeah, if you could give me a nice little graphic that said what vaccines I'm supposed to have throughout my life and how well I did, and it showed up in my, you know, standard operating information environment, I'd probably go and get my tetanus shot. As it is, you know what? I really don't want to see my doctor because the statistics show I'm actually going to be less healthy if I do. So, I mean, you know, I think that there's this sort of cart before the horse argument and this chicken and egg argument. And I think that we need to just, I mean, Kaiser's shown 50% adoption on their portal. I mean, it's wonderful.
And I think the key learning from that is that what they're able to do is offer convenience in transactions. And the number one thing people are doing on the Kaiser portal is getting their lab results, right? So I think we can learn a lot from online banking. There was a certain segment of the population that liked to see their checkbook balanced by going to Quicken and taking care of that. But it wasn't until the banks got online and you could have the convenience of actually doing bill pay that you saw a much bigger adoption. And so yeah, you'll get some people that just want to see their data, but when you can do transactions like getting your lab results or scheduling an appointment so you don't have to touch the clipboard when you go in and
email
do the
triage
or email your doctor, those types of features will then, by doing that, you begin to build up data. Just as by paying your bills online, you begin to build up data in your online bank account. And that's what will drive, I think, the 50% adoption that Kaiser and others have seen, where they actually are able to deliver transactions like labs, emailing your doctor.
You also don't need more than, I mean, actually, I think that there's sort of two numbers I think are really important. You know, if you think 5 to 10% of people that are asking good questions and measuring data change the entire system. I mean, it's shown over and over again. You only need to have a very small portion of intelligent people armed with data to change the behavior of the entire economic network. And if you have 50% adoption of any information exchange, you know, even the people that aren't using it get better care. I mean, you know that. It'll drive your physicians to be better. I mean, you're already getting that. As soon as you ask them a question, they start changing behavior, right?
Okay. Why don't we open the floor to questions and comments? There's a microphone coming here. There's a question right here.
Hi.
And if you could identify your name and if you're with an organization.
Yeah. My name is Carlos Alvarez. My question is, we talk a lot about technology and the use of these innovative technologies in healthcare. But my question is, could this actually make the system worse to an extent? Because obviously in the countries that, you know, are mentioned in Mr. West's paper, they don't have any of these innovative tools, and their outcomes are better, and they're doing it at a lower cost. Perhaps sometimes we tend to rely too much on technology to remediate some of our problems, and we don't have any data to support the idea that better outcomes are guaranteed through the use of these techniques. Should we perhaps start from a more fundamental level, saying what's wrong with the system, and then once we fix the system, how do we make that new improved system more efficient through technology? Or could we perhaps be providing crutches to patients and doctors and et cetera that may actually perpetuate bad practices over the long term?
Okay. Rob, you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, I think that's a good question and an important one to ask. And my actual response to you is look at New Zealand. Look what's happened in New Zealand in the past 5 years once they had a comprehensive patient health record keeping system across the whole country. Look at the reduction in errors in hospitals. The IOM reported several years ago that their estimate at that time was 547 Americans died every week because of errors in hospitals. And as Newt Gingrich has often said in public speeches, if two 747s crashed in the United States every week, you think we'd reform the entire aeronautics system? The New Zealand experience is really very, I think, important. There is clear evidence, okay, going back over the last several years, of reduction in errors, of improvements across a whole variety of conditions, actual improvements in clinical outcomes, and many other things. Now, they aren't the most aggressive reporters of what they're discovering, but again, to me and many of us, they are an inspiration. They're not unique, but again, there are examples of nations. Now, again, their healthcare delivery system is not the same as ours. They have a national health service, which we do not have. But nevertheless, the data are important.
You know, as an implementer of systems, I mean, certainly we all sing the mantra, just putting the technology in doesn't make anything better. And so you can't just slam the stuff in. And in fact, you know, there was so much pushback on the high-tech dollars because a lot of people saying, no, you're just going to make it worse. You're just going to, you know, automate things. You're going to make a big mess. Don't do that. I think that's the wrong attitude. It's an iterative process, but you have to start the process and change the processes and rebuild the system so the technology can do its promise. So I don't think it's going to prevent us, but it's not going to by itself solve the problem either. So we're going to have to work hard, and it's going to be iterative to not do that.
I agree with you completely. I actually think technology, and I think we have to be careful what we define technology as. I actually disagree with the High Tech Act. I disagree with forcing adoption of medical records. I think this is really dumb. I think that what matters is the questions that you ask the people you pay to do things. And I think if you ask the right questions, then they will find the most cost-effective way of answering those questions. And we currently don't ask them anything about quality or outcomes in any meaningful way. And if we asked for quality, outcome, meaningful data, they would adopt technology appropriately and efficiently, as has every other industry in the world, to answer those questions effectively to serve the market. And so I think that MRIs and CAT scans are among the lowest return on investments in the history of medicine. I think that most of the technology we deploy, and ironically, you know, people always ask us why we're not on the Microsoft Health Vault Network, which we will be eventually, and the answer is because we don't believe at the moment that there is any medically useful information in patient health records, and that the questions we ask patients, which are simple questions, how are you feeling, what's going on, determine far more, at least in the diseases we work with, about their health than any other part of the system we can work on. So I think it is about the question, not the technology, and that is a really important lost concept right now.
And if I could just add, ironically, I agree with your premise as well, and it may sound strange coming from a technology company, but one of the things we've said is that it should not be about the adoption of technology for technology's sake. It should be about where do you want to go, and that's why we're pleased that what the administration has done is tried to put stakes in. I mean, the regulations are not out yet, but the work of the HIT policy committee to say, this is what meaningful use should be about. It should be about outcomes. And let lots of innovation happen to get to those outcomes. Don't lock the world into a 2009 version of what an EHR is and jam that into every hospital and doctor. Put a stake in the ground about where you want to go, raise the bar over time, and then have innovation happen to get there. And that's why we think payment reform and consumer incentives both will be very important to get all of us in the technology industry to keep innovating and trying to think of a better way to do things.
Right there.
Hi, my name is Dina McDaddy. My question was about access. I feel the discussion has been really focusing on quality, but I was curious to see how this new burst of technology can help improve the issue of access to the United States.
It doesn't?
Well, so I think that, we started on our side. So part of what my NYP is in my mind is it's a virtual entrance to us. We've started with the giving of records. We're actively working now on the access part and saying, how can we be more self-service? How can we make it easier to get into our organizations? I think technology can help us with that. I think you look at the airline industry, you guys say, you know, when they first said, here you can check yourself in, probably weren't a lot of people checking themselves in, you know, but the you had to be comfortable. Now everybody checks their cell phone. So I think it's moving us in that direction. We haven't done as much yet. I'm hoping to really move that forward next year, but I think it gives us some potential to do more there.
What do you think you can do to improve access? Like, what are your plans down the road?
Well, so that, you know, if you're coming in, you know, I think you're pointing out, oh, God, you fill out that same piece of paper all the time. It's like, I mean, my board of trustees are like, why are we doing this? And you go see the doctor right next door and you walk. It's in the same hallway in our institution. It freaking can't even possibly make sense to yourself as a computer. And then you fill it out again on the other side of the hallway because now you're in the x-ray department, which is the hospital, not the physician. I think by moving this data this way and allowing them to do this before they come in and use it from their last visit, which was at NYU instead of at my hospital, we can start making that kind of self-service, that improvement. I think we can also start opening up our availability. Right now, it's in pockets, right? There was this great thing in on the web recently, the National Journal, about if you had to get a plane ticket the old way and call each airline and see, right? It's a disaster. That's how healthcare is. You have to call each office, each x-ray place. So I think we can break that down with this kind of data interchange. I think we're not as far along on that, but I think we can do it.
Access, I mean, you mean access as in who pays, right? I mean, at some level.
And
I mean,
what?
As in who pays. I mean,
oh, no, I thought you meant
there's a component in.
I didn't define the question the way you are.
Ah.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so, I mean, I break healthcare into two actions. There is an information problem, and then there is a problem of execution on that information or actions. And technology, you know, all the doctors in the room can shoot me now, quite frankly, can take over 80% of diagnosis and management today and should, because doctors aren't very consistent or good at it. So you can solve that half of the problem essentially for free. I mean, you know, in that case, information technology is free. The execution component, we suck at delivering particularly efficiently. And if we did that well, you could lower the cost. But at the end of the day, access, I believe, as you mean it, really means, you know, who gets paid to take your appendix out. And I don't think technology changes any of that other than make transparent the problem a little more, obviously.
I may be misinterpreting a question, but to me, an impressive healthcare institution to look at that has done important work in terms, it is the South Central Foundation in Anchorage. They are the main medical institution that provides healthcare to Native Alaskans. That is one of the most medically underserved audiences in America, or was, okay? Very low English proficiency, and antagonistic to traditional Western medical care. And yet they have been enormously successful over the last 15 years about reversing the entire attitude about going to the hospital, seeking care, and about the whole concept of taking care of yourself and prevention among a whole population where most people were not pessimistic that would be possible. Technology played a role in it. They were very aggressive in terms of telehealth. There are special circumstances in Alaska. Patients are often several thousand miles away from the facility. They did a lot with many of the things we've discussed, although they're not as advanced as some of the folks sitting on my left. But there were other things they did, too. For example, they took traditional healing seriously and blended it with Western medicine. They found a way to do it. And I won't go into more detail, but is it possible to transform, okay, how an entire community feels about healthcare? Is it possible to show not only that, but to greatly improve the outcomes? I've been there. I've seen it live. I know it can be done, but it is very difficult to do.
Okay, there's a question over there. Yes.
Raj Srinivasan, how soon is it before Americans will start using Skype and email to just communicate with primary physicians in, say, India or the Philippines and just opt out of the having the wait times associated and the costs associated with trying to get it to see a primary physician, which is I think, you know, it seems to be, at least and to your point, the incentives are not there for the U.S. to produce any more primary physicians, and it seems to be a major bottleneck in the process. And I'm wondering whether this you see this as being, is in the pipeline. using just basic Skype and email to communicate more with doctors and who may or may not even be in the United States.
Are we going to see the globalization of medicine?
It's already happening. This is live now. I mean, people are doing it now.
Yeah. I would say, one company that's sort of emerging that's interesting, it's not international physicians, but it's taking excess capacity in the U.S. physician market and doing real-time kind of on-call. A couple of companies, one called Teladoc and one called American Well, which basically allow physicians, if they have a break in their day, to do $25 consultations via the web. Both are working with HealthVault because one of the things that's critical when you do that is having the continuity of care between that person that provides that online consultation and perhaps your primary care physician if you have one. Another example is certainly international medical tourism. We announced last week that we're integrating with medical tourism, or one of the leading hospitals in Thailand that does international medical tourism, and they see about 50,000 Americans every year that travel there for lower cost care that is delivered at about 25% of the cost of the same procedure in the U.S. And one of the things we talked about was using something like HealthVault to make the continuity of care be very effective. So when you get the discharge summary from Bangkok and you end up back in Washington, D.C., you can share that information digitally with your provider. I know that's not a direct answer to your question, but those are a couple of interesting trends.
How's this going to affect your business model if patients start doing this?
Well, in essence, we're not a primary care institution in a great way. We're a place that you travel to already. But I do think these are challenges to the entire healthcare industry. I don't know that I'm the right person to answer it, but what I believe my institution to do and will do and other institutions will do is change based on on how the world changes around us. I do believe it is an international business now. It's important to us to have an international presence when it wasn't before. And so that does impact us. It is impacting how we run our business and the kinds of things we're doing. And I think we will, let it play out. Let's compete.
And America may actually be importers, not just exporters of patients. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are foreign patients coming to the United States for treatment. Yes, they're on the aisle.
Hi, my name is Dr. Caroline Poplin. I'm a primary care physician. I practiced medicine for the last 15 years, and before that I was a lawyer. And there are two problems that you haven't mentioned at all. First, that have to do with electronic medical records. First of all, we don't get paid for reading them or writing them. And what that means is there is no time in the day. If I have to see 30 patients, the last thing I want are emails from your truck driver with his blood pressures, particularly if they're high, because that's something I can't neglect. If he writes in that he's 200 over 100, I have to do something right away. And I don't want that sitting out there like a landmine. The other thing is you've got to make the records useful for us. When I started in medicine, we had nurses' notes in the hospital, long note about what the patient did. He got out of bed, then he threw up, then he went back to bed, then he had a psychotic break, then he ate breakfast. Now we have a list of boxes that are checked. That's useless, and nobody looks at it. We have notes from the residents. The residents are very clever. They're young. What they learn how to do is copy forward. So we have 15 versions of the same note, and no one writes off service notes anymore because there isn't time. And the reason there isn't time is because nobody pays for that. When I was a lawyer, I was paid for reading records. It was unprofessional not to read everything you had before you came to a meeting. And in medicine, that's just standard procedure.
I think you're reinforcing the point we've been trying to make about, and perhaps you didn't say it very well, about how payment reform really needs to drive the types of changes that will deliver sustained adoption of technology so that that physicians are paid to look at readings from patients when they're not in the 7 minutes they come in to see you as a physician, so that physicians are rewarded for that type of thing, so that hospitals are incented to be accountable for the patient more broadly, not just when they're lying in the hospital bed. So that's what we mean by payment reform, is thinking about those things that will fundamentally make economic sense for providers to use this technology. Because as Jamie and others have pointed out, there's not a lot there to have it make sense in the daily workflow today.
Yeah, so I think all of those things are true, and certainly we're all trying to do a better job. Besides the incentives, which I do think impact how your life is, and then we're just throwing stuff on it, you're talking about a problem that I feel is what we considered the medical record, the chart, when I was a nurse, was a communication tool. And therefore, it was helpful to you. Now, it's a documentation tool. It's, you know, so that you hate the EHR for the wrong reason. The EHR isn't saying you got to put these checks in. It's the requirements that, you know, our accreditation agencies are putting on us, our regulations are putting on us, and it's driving us in that place. And we, as an industry, I don't think that's a technology problem. I think, you know, it is part of what we're struggling with. So having the time and using it as a communication tool, we're really struggling, and we're inventing things on top of our EHR that are the communication tools. So I think that's getting lost, and I do worry about that, too. I hear you, and I feel it. I really do.
Kate, near the back.
Paul Shaven with Washington Hospital Center and Georgetown University Hospital. We're engaged in developing a real regional health information network in the D.C. area. And the biggest barrier has not been that we're going to perform less tests, because some of our patients won't pay for them anyway, but it's regulatory reform. We spent more time trying to deal with the regulations to protect ourselves if we share the data than with the technology. So could anybody comment on what's going to be done for regulatory reform to help provide incentives or at least protection as we try to share the information?
Well, I walk in your shoes, so I'm sympathetic. I think at some of these forums that a lot of us go to now when we're talking about connecting the system, these issues around state laws versus federal laws, privacy laws, you know, tort reform, what consumers... I believe the federal government's going to have to step in and reconcile some of these things, because they are real barriers to us, not only the business barriers, which are, I think, part of that, but those are certainly out there, and I think people are going to have to step up to the plate and get some changes. The laws are not allowing us to do all the things we'd like to do.
I actually think there's a communications issue we need to deal with here. I think it's fairly clear that we kill thousands and thousands and thousands of people every year to protect for 10 to 12 lost jobs, and I think it's so absurd that we need to just stand up and say, this is crazy. It's like literally a Vietnam War worth of deaths every year in the interest of protecting an abstract concept of privacy that's just, it doesn't even really cause any harm. I mean, and so, you know, we live in a country now where we have, you know, if you take the principle that all are created equal, the way we have chosen to enforce that is to say that you may not describe or communicate any inequality, not that you may not discriminate against inequality. So we allow discrimination and punish communication. And it's just, it's insane. I mean, the deaths to medical injuries, the deaths from slowing of advancements in medical care, the deaths and delays in clinical trials, in understanding hospital information systems, the fact that 70, 80% of every meeting is taken up with, oh my God, what if someone found out that XYZ was Y, against absolutely no evidence that I can see that ever happens, ever has a real problem, or results in any real harm. It's just got to end. I mean, we just got to stand up and say, it's time for 747s to stop dying because the aircraft controller got sick. I mean, you know, it's stupid.
The First of all, there's a very good, the last couple questions were, I think, very helpful. I'm disappointed when I don't hear people who are in leadership positions, regardless of what sector they represent, including federal government, when they talk about these issues and they don't discuss incentives and they don't discuss regulatory reforms. I think it's an incomplete discussion, and I think you ought to all, I think we're all in agreement about that. I'm a little more pessimistic than some, or excuse me, a little more optimistic than some of the people on the panel are, simply because, you know, if you look at the hospitals that are part of the system in Indianapolis, if you look at the hospitals that are part of the system in Salt Lake City, those are two cities where, there for the last 25 years, there has been and consortium of hospitals that share patient information. In some cases, patients have access to it. In some cases, they do not. But if you look at the quality of care there and you look at the enthusiasm a generation later among the primary providers and the administrators of those facilities for doing those things, even though they were the innovators and early adopters and they took all the hits, they're still, not only have the data, but qualitatively, you see a different approach and a different attitude about healthcare. It's doable. It can be done. It's been done.
Okay, I think we have time for one last question, and we'll take it right there.
Hi, I'm Fred Altman, and my question is on diagnosis. How long will it take to use the medical records to improve diagnosis to get a list of percentages of what might be the cause, and then information about how to reduce the number? And that's obviously important for the physicians. It's also important for or individuals to stop going with the disease of the week.
Good question.
I think there's been some diagnostic software around, true software, that's been pretty good for a while. I think the barrier to making that effective right now is allowing the consumer to interact iteratively with the healthcare system with data flowing in an effective way. So diagnosis is a presentation, information generation process is iterative. And no matter how much we've gotten to, it's just not happening fast enough or effectively enough. And I think there's a lot of it that could even be made virtual, that you could do it, you know, remotely and partially effectively, where you can come in a nurse, come to your office and draw things and do things effectively. The other side of that problem that I think is much more interesting and very exciting, and I think as we enter this new age of genomic healthcare, the definition of diagnosis is going to change really quickly. So, if you look at chronic fatigue syndrome, which 3 weeks ago was a psychiatric disorder, and it's now a viral disorder, that transition is going to happen really rapidly and really quickly. And I think that in that case, it demands a much more interesting medical data set, which is what is the longitudinal phenotypic measurement of the patient across multiple paradigms, and how does that begin to pattern match? And one of the things that we're looking at, we look at our MS patients in our platform, and I can look at, we're doing the analysis now, but somewhere between 2 and 10% of them are not MS patients, as far as we can tell. They never experienced impairment of their motor system or cognitive systems. It's basically pain and fatigue. So, and they're taking mainline MS drugs. So I don't know if anyone else noticed it, but I don't think Copaxone was approved for the use in chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia. Are they getting the diagnosis for political reasons, for psychiatric? So I think this is all very interesting, and at some level becomes a wonderful integrated problem of discovery and interactive healthcare. And I actually also am optimistic. I'm sort of one of those cynical optimists, which, with everything current and such. You described very beautifully in your paper what medicine could be. And I think there are places where it is beginning to be that. In the next 5 to 10 years, cancer is going to go from being, at least for the rich of us, a disease of the origin of your tumor to, I mean, if my mom had cancer today, hey, look, guys, I'm sequencing her tumor and her, and I'm running the difference. And it's been done once already, and, you know, we could afford it, we'd do it. So this will become this amazing interactive tool, and I think I'm really cautious about locking down the language. I'm really agree with you about locking down the specifications. Let's just set the goal. The goal is we should know everything about everyone and everything they did in one systems dynamic model of the American healthcare system and optimize it against all those parameters. And that is an achievable goal, which would transform our economy, healthcare, the health of the country, and make us an amazing place. And we're not even shooting for 10% of that right now. I mean, that's what I want to do.
You raise, as usual, a lot of wonderful things to talk about. But one thing we haven't mentioned is the future is mostly patients with chronic disease. 3 million people 25 years ago were alive who were diagnosed with cancer after 5 years. The figure today is 12 million plus. Cancer is rapidly becoming a chronic illness rather than acute illness. And that's just one of many. Okay, what we're going to have, what we face in the future is, can you help people over a period of many years? A term, I don't like the term manage your condition, but that's the term that clinicians use. How do we do that better? To me, that is another strong reason for health information technology and for its development. And another way of looking at it, if you don't want to put a technological term, that's the best reason for health education that I know.
Okay, I think we will conclude on that optimistic note, but I want to thank Rob, Aurelia, Jamie, and Nate for your contributions, and thank you very much for turning up.